Osho, The Perfect Master, Volume 1, Talks on Sufi Stories, Discourse Number 6, given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India.
The first question. How does the internal world of experience relate to external reality? Anurag, there are not two realities. All duality is only in conceptualization. Reality is one. It is mind that divides the lower and the higher, the good and the bad, the internal and the external, heaven and hell. It is mind that divides, but reality remains undivided. It is all one. You cannot demark where the inner ends and where the outer begins. There is no possibility of demarcation. You cannot demark where the inner ends and where the outer begins. There is no possibility of demarcation. The internal is the external, and the external is the internal. They are absolutely one. To see this is to be free of all division and of all schizophrenia. It is good to divide for intellectual purposes. It is good to categorize, to understand things. But to know reality, one has to drop all categories, all mind concepts, because they limit. They have to limit to define. You cannot define the unlimited. You have to divide and cut into pieces. Only parts can be defined. The whole cannot be defined. But the moment you cut the whole into pieces, it is no more real. The whole remains the whole. Just listen to these words of Lao Tzu. The great Tao flows everywhere, to the left and to the right. All things depend upon it to exist, and it does not abandon them. To its accomplishment it lays no claim. It loves and nourishes all things, but does not lord it over them. The Tao goes on flowing, to the left, to the right, to the sinner, to the saint. It is available. It goes on raining on all. It makes no distinctions of higher and lower, of the accepted, the chosen, and the rejected, and the condemned. The great Tao flows everywhere. It knows no boundaries. It jumps from one thing into another, from man into woman, from yin into yang. The yin goes on yanging, and the yang goes on yinning. There are moments, have you not watched into your own being? You may be a man ordinarily. Sometimes you are not a man at all. You are a woman. You may be a woman ordinarily, but sometimes you are a man. The Tao goes on flowing. Nothing can obstruct it. There are female movements in every male's consciousness, and there are male movements in every female's consciousness. Man and woman are together, undivided, two aspects of one coin. The great Tao flows everywhere, to the left and to the right. All things depend upon it to exist. It is an invisible ocean of energy, of consciousness, of bliss, Satchidananda. It is truth. It is consciousness. It is bliss. But even these three words are not three things. The idea of Trinity in Christianity is beautiful. But there are not three gods. There is only one God. Three faces. The Hindu idea of Trimurti is even more beautiful. One God with three faces. In fact, the God has as many faces as there are people. The God means the whole. Where you are going to put the God, in the external reality or in the internal? When you love, your beloved becomes part of your internal reality. Is he or she external to you? Are you external to him or her? All those old categories start disappearing. That's the beauty of love, because it makes you aware of the invisible unity of all. To its accomplishments, it lays no claim. God remains silent. Tao remains silent. It lays no claim. It loves and nourishes all things with no distinctions, but does not lord it over them. That is another thing so nice about Tao, about the real God. It is not bossy. The moment your God becomes bossy, your ego has entered in your God. You have falsified God. That's how many gods have become untrue gods. Your mind has corrupted them. You have brought all your nonsense to the concept of God. You have poisoned the very concept. The Tao loves and nourishes all things, but does not lord it over them. Thus the Tao is something purely helpful, never coercive. The Taoist never speaks of obedience, but only of being in harmony with the Tao. The internal and the outer are in harmony, in absolute harmony. They are notes, two notes of the same music. Two musical instruments in the same orchestra, in absolute harmony, being in harmony, is the way of Tao. In the moment of awakening to the real, one realizes not that he should not rebel against Tao or God, but that one simply cannot. You cannot be otherwise. Notwithstanding what you go on believing, you may think yourself as an individual. You are not, because you are not separate. Your thinking is just your thinking. It is a private idea. It corresponds to no reality at all. And hence it will create misery for you. This idea of internal and external has created much misery for man. Because then people start dropping the external. That's how the idea of renunciation arose. Renounce the outer and be the inner. But how can you do it? There is an apple on the tree. It is external. If you eat it, it becomes internal. It will be your blood, your bones, your marrow. When it becomes internal, how the external becomes internal? And one day you will die, and all that was inside you will be again outside, back into the earth. It will nourish some apple tree. More apples will grow. You breathe in, and it becomes internal. Then you have to breathe out. Where the breath becomes internal, watch. That's what Buddha says, watch your breathing. And see where it becomes internal. And where it becomes external again. Just watching your breath, all distinctions will disappear. You will see it is the same circle. The internal is the external. And the external is the internal. The moment you see this in your breath circle, you have solved a great problem. A great dichotomy is dissolved. Then you are no more a body, nor a soul. Then you don't talk about these words. Then these all words are just childish. Maybe useful, but have no reality, no truth. Just useful, utilitarian. You ask me, Anurag, how does the internal world of experience relate to the external reality? It does not relate, because they are not two. They are one. It often becomes a great question. But the question is basically false. So all the answers that have been given are false. Once you start by a wrong question, you will arrive again and again to wrong conclusions. For at least 5,000 years, man has been puzzled by one thing. The body-mind problem. How they relate. First you divide. Division is false. There is no body and no mind separate. It is body-mind. It is one entity. The mind is only a way of looking at body. And the body is also a way of looking at mind. It is the same reality. Looked from different angles. It is not two. But once you have thought that body and mind are two, then the problem arises how they relate. Just watch a small action. You think to raise your hand. How do you do it? Such a simple phenomenon, raising your hand up. How do you do it? Philosophers have been puzzled and have not been able to answer it, how it happens. Because of this internal and the external, they are the mind, and the body is being raised. How the body can follow the order from the mind? Mind is invisible, immaterial. Body is visible, material. How matter can follow mind? What is the link? How it is translated into body language? How it corresponds? But to me, basically the problem is wrong. There are not two entities in you. it is all one. Then the problem disappears. You ask me how the internal relates with the external reality. There are not two realities. There is no question of internal and external. They don't relate. They are one. How two lovers relate with one another? If they are lovers, they don't relate. They are simply one. In love, they know the unity. If they are not lovers, then they relate. Then relationship is not much. It is more conflict and less relating. It is more fight than being together. If love has happened in that moment, it becomes absolutely clear that there is no division. Then they start functioning in a harmony. And not that the harmony has to be imposed from the outside. No, it comes on its own accord, with no effort, with no cultivation, with no conditioning. It simply happens as trees grow upwards. Just like that. As birds can fly, just like that. As flowers can bloom, just like that. It is natural. The internal and the external are in absolute harmony. There is no division. But man has created the division and has created much anxiety about it. Drop the division and go beyond anxiety. Dropping dualities, one becomes religious. Don't think yourself separate from the world. That's why Zen people say, the world is nirvana. There is no other enlightenment. That's why the other day I was talking about Zorwa the Buddha. Zorwa is extrovert. Buddha is introvert. Zorwa has no idea who he is. Buddha has renounced the world. He only thinks about who he is. His whole consciousness moves inward. Zorwa is interested in women and wine and dance and song. His whole energy moves outwards. To me, the perfect master will be one who has no divisions. He flows in all the directions, internal, external, because there is no problem at all. It is all one flow. To be in this one flow is to know God. The second question, I have fallen in love with a friend's wife who is in love with my wife. Is it not strange? It is. This whole life is strange. Things happen here. Strange things. I can understand your problem. No husband can ever believe that anybody can fall in love with his wife. Although he can fall with somebody else's wife and there is no problem. But somebody falling in love with his wife, and he is so fed up with the woman, and he cannot see any beauty in her, and all ugliness has surfaced. A man came home and saw his partner making love to his wife. The partner was very much afraid. Now there is going to be trouble. And the man came and tapped on his shoulder and said, "Come with me to the other room. I would like to have a word with you." And the partner was trembling. Now there is going to be danger, maybe some fight or something. And the man took him into the other room and closed the doors and said, "Tell me one thing. I have to, but why you? What has happened to you? Have you gone crazy or something? I can understand your problem. Somebody falling in love with your wife. Let me tell you one anecdote. Two men were playing golf one morning, but could not play as quickly as they wanted because there were two women playing the hole ahead of them who were moving too slowly. Finally, out of their frustration, one of the men began walking towards the woman to ask them to stop gossiping so much and to play golf, or to please get out of the man's way. He got within 100 feet of the women and all of a sudden stopped, turned around and ran back to his friend. "You had better go," he said. "One of them is my wife and the other is my mistress." So the second man started walking towards the women. He got within 150 feet of the ladies and he too turned around and ran the other way. He got back to his friend and said, "Small world." The third question. Jewish religion, like Zen, is based only on the formless and does not permit the worship of forms. But ever since I have been in India, these last 8 years, I have moved away from this idea and have fallen in deep love, not only with your form, but also with Hindu religion, its multitude of mythological figures and the stories around them, Rama, Krishna, Shiva, etc. I love keeping my room decorated with pictures of your form and of all these as well, and immersing myself in the feeling of being surrounded by an Indian mythological world of gods and goddesses, though intellectually I know the illusion of it. I also love form by way of the Indian trees, skies and nature, as well as the Indian people in general and in particular, and I seem to come alive here in India in a great heart-throbbing dance of joy as I never could feel living in the West. My head knows the truth of the concept of the formless and of the idea of killing the Buddha, but my heart is absolutely immersed in the love and worship of form. I even have no desire for enlightenment anymore and would rather love Buddha than become him in these my own ways. Does this mean I'm stuck somewhere and need you to be a Totapuri to cut my forehead? Or is it okay for me to remain in my present ecstatic, heart-throbbing world? Anand Prem. The Jewish concept of God as formless and the Zen concept are not the same. Zen has no concept of God. Because how can you have a concept of a formless God? That is absurdity. The moment you have a concept, you have created a form. That's why Zen never talks about God. Buddha never mentioned God at all. He has been asked again and again, but he keeps mum. He will not say. If you talk about the formless God, what you are talking? What do you mean by formless God? If you contemplate on the formlessness of God, you will be surprised. Either you have to drop the idea of God like Buddha, like Zen, or you have to create some form. Either the formlessness can remain and God has to go, or God can remain, but then the formlessness has to go. So remember it. Zen has no idea of God. Formlessness cannot be called God. The moment you call it any name, you have given it a certain form. The formlessness is falsified, is destroyed. It is no more formless. About the formless God, you can be only silent. You cannot even say that much, that God is formless. That is profane, that is sacrilegious. You cannot define in any way. Not even you are allowed to say that God is indefinable, because that becomes a definition. You have said something. You have already said something. And you are saying nothing can be said. Buddha is in that way very logical. Zen is very clear. Judaism is not so clear. It is against creating forms of God. That is true. But it's being too much against simply shows it is obsessed with the idea of form. That's how Mohammedans are also obsessed, because they are an offshoot of Judaism. Judaism is obsessed that there should be no statue of God in any temple. And Mohammedans have gone one step further, that if you find any statues, destroy them. Free people of the forms of God, as if you can free anybody from the forms of God. Because forms exist in the mind, not in the temples. They are not in the statues, but in the intellectual visualization of God. Why Judaism should not permit the worship of forms? The very effort to deny forms shows that somehow you are still attached with the form. It is not formlessness. It may be anti-form attitudes, but not formlessness. Zen is really formlessness. And because of this, just as Prem says, Jewish religion, like Zen, is based only on the formless and does not permit the worship of forms. If God is formless, who are you to permit or not to permit? The very idea of permitting is destructive to freedom. Judaism has not given freedom to people. It is not just an accident that all the revolutionaries have come from Jews. It is a rebellion. From Jesus to Freud, all the revolutionaries have come from the Jews. Why? No other religion has created so many revolutionaries. No other religion is so restrictive. If a religion is free, the revolutionary has nothing to do there. Hinduism has not created any revolutionaries. Buddhism has not created any revolutionaries. Why? Because the freedom is so total. What is the point? If Jesus was born in India, nobody would have thought about him that he is a revolutionary. People would have allowed, because there is no question Who is there to allow or not to allow? It is everybody's one's own choice. Because Jews have not been allowing forms. Jesus was born. And Jesus became the form of God for Christians, for millions of people. And then it has been happening again and again. Marx comes out of Jews. And Albert Einstein. And Sigmund Freud. Why? The religion is very restrictive. It does not have the flavor of Zen. And when I am talking about Jews, I leave aside the Hasid masters. They have the flavor of Zen. But Jews don't accept them either. They are thought to be rebellious. And whenever religion becomes too much interested into permitting and not permitting, it becomes ritualistic, dull, dead. It becomes formal. Just see the point. Jews talk about the formlessness of God, and their whole religion has become absolutely formal. Just ritualistic. Nothing of the interior, nothing of the heart. Just a social formality. I have heard the couple were registering at a small hotel in Vermont. They were asked to show their wedding license. The man flashed a fishing license to the near-sighted clerk and laid it on the desk. After the couple went upstairs, the clerk examined the license more carefully and rushed up after them. He banged on the door, shouting, "If you ain't done it, don't do it. This ain't the license for it." Who can permit? Who can give you a license for anything? If there is any possibility to know God, it is through freedom. It is through absolute freedom. You say, but coming to India, I have moved away from this idea. It is good that you have moved away from this idea. That was just an idea, not your experience. But now you have moved to another idea, just the opposite. That's what has been happening to Jews down the ages. When they rebel, they move to the opposite idea. Just the opposite. It always happens. You react and you move to the other extreme. Now, Prem says, she has moved away from this idea. You may have moved, but you have moved in the opposite direction. Now she is surrounded by all kinds of gods and goddesses, Rama, Krishna, Shiva. In India, you have millions of gods. They say there are more gods than people in India. I have known people whose whole day is lost into worshipping. I used to stay with a man. He had at least 300 statues in his small temple, his own temple. 300 statues of all kinds of gods and goddesses. And from 4 o'clock early in the morning, he will start worshipping. You have to take care of 300 guards. Half the day was wasted in it. And he was in such a hurry because he could not worship even one. Because he knows now there are still 299 waiting. And he has to rush to everybody. And he has to be careful, otherwise somebody may become angry. Those 300 jealous guards, you have to pay same attention to each. He was getting crazy. I said, you will go mad. 300 guards are too much. Now Prem says he is feeling ecstatic. Yes, you will feel ecstatic because you have moved to the opposite polarity. It gives freedom. But this is not true freedom. Soon you will lose it. Soon you will become tired. And then there is every possibility the mind will start moving to the other extreme again. And the truth is just exactly in the middle. Remember, the truth is just exactly in the middle. In the ancient Greece, on the temple of Adelphi, there were two inscriptions. One is very well known. The other is not so well known. There must be some cause why the other never became so well known. One was, know thyself. And the other was, never in excess. But the other is not so well known. And the both are together. The both are as important as the other. Of same plenitude. Of same potential. One can know oneself only if one lives a life of no excess, if one moves just in the middle. Otherwise, one becomes a victim of extremes. Now, from the idea of formless God, you are becoming a victim of thousands of forms. Just exactly in the middle, where gods disappear. Neither form nor formlessness. When there is utter silence, there is the home. And Prem says, I even have no desire for enlightenment anymore and would rather love Buddha than become him. Reading to your question, Prem, I started becoming worried about Buddha. It is perfectly okay, you will love Buddha, but what about Buddha? Your love will be your love with all its poison. In fact, your love is not love at all. Only through light, love arises. Only after enlightenment, love flows. Before that, it is just a false illusion of love. You can go on loving Buddha, but you will never know what Buddha is. How can you love? Your love will be nothing but a kind of illusion, a hallucination. You have loved people before. Now you project the same illusory energy on Buddha. And if Buddha is alive, he won't allow it. He will try to destroy it in every way. Because he will think of you in this illusion, in this dream, You may feel good, but this is a dream. All the same, sooner or later you will awake, and then you will see that you have been wasting your life. Yes, there is excitement, but there is no ecstasy. And don't think your excitement is ecstasy. They look alike. And the greatest danger in life is from things that look alike. Excitement looks like ecstasy. They are not. Ecstasy has no excitement. It is a very tranquil state. Ecstasy is absolute silence, nothingness. It is enlightenment. Now you say, I even have no desire for enlightenment. In a way, that is good. Because if you don't have any desire for enlightenment, enlightenment becomes more possible. But the way you are saying it seems that you are clinging. You are afraid. It is not just a statement of no desire. It is a statement of rejection. You are afraid of enlightenment. You are afraid to become so conscious, because then all these illusory loves will disappear and all these mythological gods that you are surrounded with will look stupid. You will have to throw them down in the river. You will have to get rid of them, because they are unnecessarily occupying space. You cannot love Buddha unless you become a Buddha. And to become a Buddha is what enlightenment is, and that's what ecstasy is. Prem, you are not in an ecstasy. You may be in a heart-throbbing excitement. You may be enjoying this trip, but how long? And these gods that you are surrounded with are all nothing but your projections. You have created them. You can put your energy into Rama, and then he becomes alive, but it is your energy. Why not become yourself alive? Why put it in Rama and make him alive? Why go that far? And you say, does this mean I am stuck somewhere and need you to be a Totapuri to cut my forehead? I am not a Totapuri. Ramakrishna was too much attached with form, and Totapuri was too much attached with formlessness. I am not attached at all. To me, both are the same. Attachment to form or to formlessness is the same. I am not giving you a formless God. I am not trying to substitute form with formlessness. No, I want you to draw form and formlessness both and just be free of all illusions. In that just being is freedom. Meditate on these lines of Jack Kerouac. There is no way to lose. If there was a way, then when the sun is shining on pond and I go west, thou east, which one does the true sun follow? Which one does the true one borrow? Since neither one is the true one, there is no true one way, and the sun is a delusion of a way multiplied by two and multiplied millionfold. Since there is no way, no Buddhas, no Dharmas, no conceptions, only one ecstasy. And right-mindedness is mindfulness, that the way is no way, anyhow, same way. Only one ecstasy. Ecstasy has nothing to do with form or formlessness. Ecstasy has nothing to do with Judaism, Hinduism, Buddhism. Only one ecstasy. And what is that? I teach you only that. And what is that? That is being so utterly quiet, unmoving, not going anywhere, not desiring anything, not dreaming anything. Gods are no gods, forms are no forms. No thought at all. The thought of form, the thought of formlessness are all the same. Can't you be in that mirror-like silence? Nothing is reflected even. The mirror is empty. That is this one ecstasy. That one ecstasy is God. The taste of it is God. God is not a person with form or without form. God is the taste on your tongue of that moment. Of that moment of bliss. Of that moment of Tao. Of that moment when all stops, time stops and the world stops. I am not a Totapuri at all. He was very much obsessed with the formless. Otherwise, why he should bother to cut Ramakrishna's forehead? I would not have done that. For what? I am not in any way interested to change you from one position to another position, from one philosophy to another philosophy. They are all point of views. My effort is to make you free of all point of views, Ramakrishna and Totapuri both. And what happened, do you know? And that's what I am afraid, Prem. It can happen to you. Ramakrishna said after those 6 days that the last barrier has fallen. And then he lived at least 10 years and continued to worship Kali. And the day he died with the name of Kali on his lips. Jai Kali, Jai Kali. The day, the moment he died, it was not the formless. It was again the form. What happened? For a few days, he remained in that excitement of the formless. Then he became tired and moved again. No excess, no extreme. Be in the middle. Exactly in the middle is the door. If you think of time, then in the past there is no door, in the future there is no door, but in the present, because that is exactly in the middle. If you think of form and formlessness, there is no door, but exactly between the two. Neither this nor that. Neti neti. Just exactly between the two. Neither the soul nor the body. Don't become a spiritualist or a materialist. Don't think of the external reality or the internal. Just exactly in the middle. Always go on thinking of the middle. And slowly, slowly relax in the middle and let the extremes dissolve. And you have arrived home. The third question. Beloved Bhagwan, kindly tell me, have we met in a past life? Chit Vilas, we have not even met in this life. What you are talking about, the past life. You have been here, I have been here, but meeting has not happened yet. I go on trying to meet you and you go on escaping. You are very artful, skillful, clever. And you know it. And to avoid this encounter, you are interested in thinking about past lives. Ask me why we have not met in this life. How it is going to help whether we met in the past life or not? Now we cannot go back to it. We cannot make anything out of it. It is finished. But this is how mind works. It escapes from the present. It finds ways either in the past or in the future. Those are tricks, strategies of the mind to save itself. Why you should be interested of past life? It is finished. It is gone. It is no more. It has no existence anywhere, no validity. Even if we had met, it matters nothing. The only thing that matters is I am here and you are here, but the meeting is not happening. If the meeting happens, you will become enlightened. And let only that be decisive. The day you become enlightened, the meeting has happened. Otherwise, what is the point? And I know that you know it, because you have also asked another question which will make it clear. Chidbilas asks, I strongly feel to go through that beautiful initiation ceremony again. What am I missing which I got while you allowed me to enter your kingdom? Please throw some light on this feeling and on missing. You know it. You are missing. The initiation ceremony is not going to help. No ceremony is going to help. It is not a question of any ceremony. It is a question of risk. You have to be courageous to encounter me, to face me, to face the reality that I am making available to you, and you go on dodging. This way and that you go on running. And your mind is full of knowledge. So you can always find excuses, explanations, rationalizations. That's why the meeting is not happening. Now this is another effort out of your knowledge. You want to know whether we have met in some past life? If I say yes, your ego will be strengthened. You will start thinking yourself very special. That is the desire in it. So even if we have met, I am not going to say it. All I am going to say it is, meet me now. Because there may be no more another life for me. You may not meet me again. No possibility. Don't miss this opportunity. And remember, initiation ceremony is not going to help. It has not to be just a ceremony. It has to be existential. You are initiated as a sannyasin. But that has not helped either. Just by becoming a sannyasin, you don't become. It is just a preliminary. It helps. It brings you a little closer. It makes you a little open, a little more trusting. But it is not the end. The real initiation is going to happen someday when you will drop all your mind and you will just look into me with no idea, with no knowledge, with innocence. Remember Josiah? And those children who looked into his eyes. The day you will look into my eyes as if you are a child, innocent, with no past, with no future. then the meeting will happen. And that meeting is going to transform you. I'm waiting for it. I'm working for it. I'm surrounding you from everywhere. But up till now, it has not happened because of you. You go on escaping. Stop escaping. The fifth question, why are the psychotherapists called shrinks? Because they are. The word exactly describes what the psychotherapists are doing. They shrink people. They shrink people from persons into patients. That's their work. They reduce. When you go to a psychotherapist, you go as a person with dignity. They reduce you immediately to labels. You are a schizophrenic, paranoid, neurotic. Immediately you are reduced. You are no more the same person with the dignity. A label has been put on you. You are a disease. You have to be treated. By reducing you into a patient, the psychotherapist has become very bigger. The more he reduces you to a smallness, the bigger he feels. This is an old trip, only the names have changed. In the past, it was the priest. Now it is the psychotherapist. In the past, the priest was shrinking you, trying to create the guilt feeling, trying to create the feeling that you are wrong somehow, that you need to be changed, that you are not acceptable as you are, that you are getting ready for hell. The whole effort of the priest was to reduce you into criminal sinners. The priest was creating a kind of guilt feeling in you. Now the work has been taken up by the psychotherapist. Psychotherapist is the priest of the new age. He reduces you. He does not enhance you. He does not give you splendor, respect for your being. On the contrary, he makes you feel worthless. And that's why we are trying to create a new kind of therapy here, in which you are not reduced to diseases, but enhanced, expanded. The psychotherapist is not there to label you as ill, but is there only to help you, to know that you are not ill. That who says that you are ill? That you are carrying wrong notions about yourself? Who has told you that you are worthless? You are immensely valuable. That is my whole effort here, to help you expand. The psychotherapist and the priest and the so-called gurus, they have been all doing the same thing to people. They have been shrinking them. They have reduced humanity into worms, crawling on the earth, ugly, afraid of seeing their own faces in the mirror, afraid to look into their own beings, because there is nothing but all that is wrong, wounds and pus. Here the effort is to create a totally different kind of therapy, true to the very meaning of the word. The meaning of the word therapy is that which heals. And what heals? Love heals. Love is therapy. Nothing else is therapy. Not psychoanalysis. Not analytical psychology. Only love heals. Healing is a function of love. But love expands your consciousness. It allows you to go higher and higher and touch the stars. It makes you feel respected. It makes you feel that you are needed in existence, that without you there will be something missing in existence. There will be a hole without you, unfulfillable. You are a must. This existence cannot be the same without you. You are not just an accident. You are essentially needed. Let me remind you of Jussieu again. Jussieu is one of the most beautiful masters. You can call him the perfect master. One day he was caught praying in the synagogue. Why caught? Because the people felt very offended. He was saying to God, "Listen, I need you, so you need me. Without you, I will be nothing. And I say to you, without me, you will be nothing. I am I because of you. You are you because of me." The people were offended. They said, "What you are saying, Jussieu? Have you gone mad?" He has not gone mad. This is the way one should have a dialogue with God. This is not ego, not at all. This is a simple fact. Even a small leaf of grass is as much valuable as any star. There is no hierarchy in existence. Nobody is lower and nobody is higher. We are all joined into one organic unity. This is real therapy. Therapy, when it is real, will be nothing but love. Therapy, when real, will help you to regain your confidence, will help you to bloom. The word Buddha comes from a root, bodha. In the ancient days, the word bodha was used for the opening up of a bud. It comes from the world of flowers. Then it was taken over. Bodha means originally opening up of a bud and becoming a flower. Then it was taken in a metaphoric sense. When a man opens up, blooms, religious fragrance and colors, and dances in the sky, he becomes a Buddha. He has opened up. Real therapy does not shrink you. It opens you up. It makes you all that is yours available to you. It gives you your last treasure. But as far as the modern psychotherapy is concerned, people are right in calling psychotherapists shrinks. They are. And the strange thing is this, that they are as ill as the people they are treating. Sometimes even more so. I have never come across a psychotherapist who is not mentally in some disturbance. Maybe just to avoid his own mental disturbance, he has become interested into other people's mental disturbances. And he is playing superior. And he is getting more and more ill every day. I have heard a motion picture actor told his psychiatrist, "I am attracted to men instead of women." The shrink replied, "You have come to the right place, handsome." They are suffering from the same kind of problems. Pretending to help people. Psychotherapy is one of the most bogus things that has happened to this age. But a totally different kind of orientation is needed. People get in trouble. Not that people are wrong, but because people are brought up in wrong situations. Everybody is born perfectly healthy and normal, but is born in a neurotic society where parents are neurotic, teachers are neurotic, priests are neurotic, politicians are neurotic, and they all jump upon the small child and they start manipulating him. They drive him crazy. We have not yet been able to develop a right kind of bringing up. The science remains very rudimentary, primitive. We have come from bullock carts to jets. But as far as rearing of a child is concerned, we are as primitive as ever. We have not evolved about that. Parents go on pouring their diseases into the children. And children are helpless victims. And in their own turn, they will have nothing to give to their children. They will have to give their illnesses. That's all they have. People are not neurotic. It is a neurotic atmosphere. And just by analyzing people's neuroses, you are not going to transform them either. Just by analyzing, at the most, you can help them to become a little more adjusted. You can make them feel that that's how life is. Freud says, there is no possibility of enjoyment in life. One can only endure it. If you go through psychoanalysis, sooner or later you will see this is what life is. All this nonsense, all this rubbish, all these neurotic desires, this is what life is. One starts settling with it. One loses hope, becomes settled. What is the point of raging against it? It is to no purpose. There is no enjoyment possible. Psychoanalysis is very pessimistic. It is very strange. People say Buddha is pessimistic. Even Freud and people like that say Buddha is pessimistic. This is really strange. Buddha is not pessimistic. Neither is Shankara, nor is Rumi. These people are not pessimistic, although they say that life is full of misery, but they say it only to make you aware that it should not be so, that it need not be so. Life is misery, they say again and again, because life can be bliss. They simply provoke you to take your life in your own hands. It can be transformed into bliss. They are not pessimists. Freud is a pessimist. Psychotherapists are pessimists. They have accepted this is all that is life is supposed to be. One has to live with it. One has to endure it somehow. They make people capable to cope with it, but this is not much just to cope with. And then comes death. No, life can be a dance. Life can be a song. A real therapy will not only help you to cope with life, it will help you to become more alive. It will help you to gain life abundance. It will help you to move towards Sachidananda. It will help you to attain to eternal bliss. Only then it is therapy, but then it is no more a kind of shrinking, then it is expansion. In fact, the original Hebrew word for heaven means expansion. When Jesus says, the kingdom of heaven is within you, he is saying metaphorically that if you expand, if you expand to the very ultimate limits of existence, this is what kingdom of heaven is. Real therapy will be of a totally different color, shape, flavors. This is why I am so much interested in therapy. You will not find anybody else in the whole of India so much interested in therapy. To have therapies in an ashram is unheard of. But my interest is deep in it, because I know therapy is doing much wrong to people. It has moved in a very, very pessimistic dimension. And therapy is the religion of the modern man. Just go on talking about Bible and Quran and Vedas is almost out of date. It is meaningless. It has no relevance. One has to talk to the relevant situation and to the real problems people are facing in their life. Therapy is one of the things that has to be changed, transformed, so that it can become a healing force. So that it can bring you towards more wholeness and holiness. The sixth question, do real problems exist? Are all problems just mind games? Does awareness make problems disappear? Or is there a possibility that awareness brings repression? I find that whenever I feel a little more centered and aware than usual, I don't feel any problems. But when I am no more centered, all the old problems are back and they look even bigger. Is this repression? Ratna, all problems are out of unawareness. unawareness creates problems is the only problem, really. So when you become alert, aware, problems disappear. They are not repressed. And if you repress them, you will never become aware. Remember it. Because a person who represses his problems will be afraid of becoming aware. The one who has repressed problems, the moment he will become aware, those problems will come up. Awareness will bring them to light. It is like if you are hiding rubbish in your house, you will be afraid to bring light in. Because then you will have to see all that that you have been hiding there. You cannot bring light in. I used to live in a village once for a few days. There was a river so dirty, just such a small river, you cannot even call it a river. And there was no other way, no other water supply. A guest came to stay with me. Now I was a little puzzled how to take him to the dirty river. So I took him early, 4 o'clock in the morning. And we enjoyed. And we talked about the beauty because the moon was there. And the river was really looking beautiful. And he enjoyed and he said, I have never seen such a beautiful spot. I said, that's perfectly okay, but never come in the day. He said, why? I said, just don't come. Naturally, he rushed. By the morning, he went back. And he came from there. He said, such a dirty place. But it was looking so beautiful. If you repress, you will become afraid of becoming aware. That's why millions of people are afraid of becoming aware. Awareness will bring light into you. And then you will see all the scorpions and the snakes and the wolves. And that is frightening. One keeps oneself in darkness. At least one can go on pretending that there is no problem. Awareness will release all that is repressed. Awareness never represses. On the contrary, it releases repressions. But Ratna's experience is true. If you become aware, problems disappear. Naturally, the question arises, is not awareness repressing those problems? Because suddenly how they can disappear? And when awareness is lost, centering is gone, and you are no more so conscious, again the problems pop up and they are bigger than ever. So natural conclusion is awareness repressed them. It is not so. When you are unconscious, you create problems. Unconsciousness has its own language. That is the language of problems. It is like you are groping in darkness. One thing falls, you stumble upon another thing. These are problems because of the darkness. If light comes, you will not stumble upon the table. And nothing will fall. You can move now easily. You will be able to see. But when it is dark, try to move in your own house. And many accidents will happen. You may not be able to find the door in the night. You may not be able to find where things are. In darkness, the way you live creates problems. Darkness or unconsciousness only understands the language of problems. It has no solutions. Even if a solution is given to you, in your unconsciousness, you will make a problem out of it. That's what goes on happening. If I say something to you, you understand something totally different. You understand from your standpoint. A spinster school teacher on her summer vacation was visiting the reservation at Yos Mait. She stopped a big brave standing against a tree and became very curious about his sex life. "How does a great big man like you get satisfaction up here where there are no young squaws?" she asked. The Indian stared at her unbelievingly and then said, "You see cow?" "Yes, I see cow." "You don't mean?" "Yes," said the brave. "Me make love to cow." "Also you see horse?" "Yes," said the spinster, horrified. "I see horse. Me make love to horse." "Ah, dear," cried the distraught old maid. "No," grunted the Indian sadly. "No make love to deer. Run too fast." Unconsciousness understands in its own way. That's why Buddhas are always misunderstood. That's a natural fate. It can't be avoided. It is very difficult to understand a Buddha. It is very easy and natural to misunderstand him. To understand him will require great awareness on your part. Because he lives in the world where there are no problems, where there are all solutions and solutions and no problems, all answers and no questions. And you live in a world where there are only questions and questions and no answers. You live so far away, as if you are living on different planets. He goes on shouting from there. But whatsoever reaches to you is totally different. And you can always find rationalizations for whatsoever you understand. You can become very argumentative, defensive too. Guillaume was seated in the witness stand. He had already calmly answered all the questions of the prosecuting attorney. Now it was the judge's turn. "Does the defendant really expect this court of law to accept his story that the completely assembled still on his property was not being used for the purpose of producing illicit whiskey?" "That's right, Your Honor," says Guillaume. "I bought that as a novelty, a conversation piece. I do not now, nor have I ever operated it, as a still to produce whiskey." "Hogwash," howled the magistrate. "As far as this court is concerned, possession of the equipment is proof enough of your guilt." "Then, Your Honor, I guess you had also better charge me with raping your daughter." "What?" screamed the judge. "Did you rape my daughter too?" "No, sir," said Guillaume. "But she was at my place last night and I sure got the equipment for it." Mind is very cunning and clever. It can argue in clever ways. It can even find rationalization and proofs. It can give you the feel as if you have understood rightly. But Ratna's question is of immense importance. It is of importance for everybody who is here. Because this is a place where you have to become more and more aware. Awareness has to become the climate. Do real problems exist? They exist only when you are unconscious. Then they are real. If unconsciousness is there, they are real. Just as dreams exist when you are asleep. Are they real? Yes, when you are asleep. They are absolutely real. But when you are awake, you know they are unreal. They were unreal. They were part of sleeping consciousness. Exactly like that, problems exist if you are not centered, not alert. If you become centered, alert, watchful, a witness, problems simply dissipate, evaporate. Are all problems just mind games? Yes. They are all mind games. And mind is nothing but another name for unconsciousness. Does awareness make problems disappear, or is there a possibility that awareness brings repression? It depends on you. There is a little danger of it. If you force awareness upon yourself, it will be repressive. If you allow awareness to take possession of you, it will be non-repressive. If you practice awareness stubbornly, if it is a kind of will, then you will repress. Will always represses. Will is the source of repression. Wherever will is, there will be repression. So your consciousness has not to be out of willpower. It has to be out of understanding. It has to be relaxed. It has to be kind of let go, not enforced. That is one of the most essential things to understand. If you try to become aware, you will repress. For example, anger has arisen, and you try to become aware of the anger stubbornly, forcibly, violently, aggressively, actively, with will. With that effort, anger will recede back. It will fall into the reservoir of your unconscious. It will move into the basement of your being and will wait there. When your effort is gone, and effort cannot be continuous because effort tires. You can make effort, will, for a moment, for few moments, for few hours, or for few days, but sooner or later you will need a holiday. You will be tired of the whole effort. And the moment you will be on a holiday, the anger will come back, and with greater force. Because while it was repressed, it became pressurized.